be waiting for you, baby. I'll be waiting for you there. So drink to me, drink to my health. You know I can't drink anymore.
The history of civilization is in many ways the history of wine. Wine, of course, is many things. It's a splendid drink, to be sure, but it's also a means of social interaction, a means of entertaining people, a political currency, and more. So what are the origins of wine? When was it first created? By whom and how? That's the subject of a new book by our guest this week, Patrick McGovern, titled Ancient Wine, The Search for the Origins of Viniculture. Patrick McGovern is a molecular archaeologist, a senior research scientist at the University of Pennsylvania Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology, and an adjunct professor of anthropology at the University of Pennsylvania. Welcome, Patrick.
Good evening, Brian.
Let's start with, how'd you come to be interested as an archaeologist now, not as a consumer, in the origins of wine?
Well, it really started by somebody coming to me with an unusual sherd from Iran that had a reddish residue on the inside and asking me if I would do an analysis of that. She was very convinced, this is a woman named Jenny Babler, that she had a wine jar dated to about 3000 BC.
So a shard is a piece of pottery.
Right, a piece of a large jar that would have contained probably about 10 liters originally.
Okay. And how'd you take? Where'd you go from there?
Well, we were very skeptical because this is a 5,000-year-old vintage that she was proposing that we could analyze for. And in our experience, a lot of these organic compounds, you know, wouldn't stay around that long. But we had worked on something called royal purple, which was one of the most famous dyes in antiquity, where we had very well-preserved purple going back about 3,000 years. And so we gave it a shot with the sherds from Iran.
Now, you pushed the origins of viniculture back quite a ways from people who used to think it was maybe 2,000 or 3,000 years, and now you've got it back to about 8,000 years ago. And what evidence do you have for this?
Well, this has all been, you know, built up over time as we've done more and more vessels, you know, from different parts of the Near East and Egypt. What we're basically doing is looking for fingerprint compounds that tell us that a grape is present, a grape product. You know, it could be grape juice, vinegar, or wine. And the principal compound that we're looking for is tartaric acid, which is found in grapes in fairly large amounts. And it's very characteristic of grapes in the Middle East. I mean, so there's no other natural source that can really account for tartaric acid other than grapes if you find it in the Middle East.
And how do you differentiate that, for, let's say, it rather being grape juice or wine? How do you tell the difference?
Well, there is where we get into sort of an archaeological argument, because we can't, you know, demonstrate absolutely that we have, you know, any one of these grape products. But if you have a jar in which it has a fairly narrow mouth and you can argue that it was used for a liquid, that would have, and you can show that it had a large component of grape, so you have some sort of a grape juice, that will start to ferment very quickly, especially in a hot climate in the first few days, and you'll start to get the grape juice turning to wine because there's yeast on some of the grape skins. So that'll happen naturally. Then the real issue is, how do you keep, you know, that wine that's going to be produced quite naturally from turning into vinegar? And there's that's where we really developed a whole, you know, set of thought and scientific evidence that would point to it, you know, being intentionally preserved. For instance, you will find clay stoppers that fit into the mouths of these vessels, and this clay acts a little bit like cork. They didn't have cork in those days, but the clay will absorb the liquid and expand and then keep out oxygen that would cause it to go to vinegar. Then the other argument that we use to make a case for wine rather than vinegar is that most of our ancient samples have a tree resin that's been added to the wine intentionally, and this would help to keep the wine. The only country today that actually uses this method is Greece, where you have a wine called Retsina. So it's kind of an acquired taste, you know, but in antiquity we have evidence that tree resins were being added regularly to the wines.
And that was used to preserve them?
That would have helped in preserving them because there's antioxidant properties in the tree resin. And the tree resins actually are used in combination with wine in many of the ancient medicines, too, from Egypt to Mesopotamia.
Oh, interesting. All right, now, you found the origins of wine, or I don't know if we've been correct using that term, perhaps we should say a fermented beverage that contained grapes, occurring nearly simultaneously in two parts of the world, which were really quite distant from one another, the Caucasus of Georgia and in China. And there's no real evidence that they had any contact with one another. So is this really a matter of two peoples at great distance not talking to one another, stumbling on the same idea at roughly the same time?
Well, we think, that each of these cultures in East Asia and Western Asia are developing about the same time. You know, they're starting to domesticate different plants and animals. There's village life being developed. There's still a big issue about what kind of communication was going on across Central Asia. And, you know, we can't be sure that there's any direct communication. There may be, you know, sort of piecemeal spread of ideas from, you know, place to place. And so if you get, you know, one group of people in Western Asia starting to experiment with different plants and domesticating them, and that just that idea somehow is, you know, spread in other areas and eventually makes its way across to China, they would start experimenting with the plants that they have there. They're going to be different kinds of plants. Grape is one of those plants, though, that is actually common to both areas, although it's different species that we're talking about. But, I mean, I would think that it's some kind of an independent invention in both of those areas. It just happens to occur about the same time because they're developing at about the same rate, and, you know, they have access to, you know, a range of plants that they can actually start to domesticate and that are sugar-rich enough to make into a fermented beverage.
Okay, well, let me pick up on that species reference and go to what I think is an even more interesting point. And you suggest in your book that 99% of the wine in existence today sort of comes from the same subspecies of wild grape. What's the grape? Where did it grow 8,000 years ago, and how did it come to dominate the world?
Well, the grape is Vitis vinifera, and then the subspecies is Sylvestris, which is the wild plant. It's also called the Eurasian grape. It actually exists in the wild form, although it's being rapidly wiped out because of development, all the way from Spain across to Central Asia. But the area where it has its greatest genetic variability and is therefore sometimes called the world center of the grape is in the upland area that sort of encompasses eastern Turkey, Transcaucasia, Georgia, Armenia, and then across over into northwestern Iran. And that's where we have the earliest archaeological evidence of some form of a, what I call, wine culture developing, in which you would have had the domestication of the grape, the Eurasian grape, occurring.
And you had it just in that one location, but then you suggest that it was transported to and transplanted to other parts of the world, even though the grape grew in many different locations. You suggest this is what, the Noah hypothesis?
Well, yes. I mean, we can call it this idea that there's a single point, you know, in time of domesticating of this Eurasian grape, you know, probably around 6000 BC, maybe even earlier, and refer to that as the Noah hypothesis. It's a little bit similar to, you know, you have what's called the Eve hypothesis, where you try to trace human origins back to Africa and a single mother. You know, there's a lot of debate about that. Well, the parable of Noah, you could take as illustrating a similar kind of first domestication for the grape, because Noah, when he got off his ark on Mount Ararat, the first thing he did actually was, according to the story, was to plant a vineyard and make wine.
Oh, right. Okay, get the connection.
But, you know, whether we can actually prove, you know, that there is a single domestication and where that occurred, that is, you know, really ongoing research right now, you know, looking at DNA evidence of modern wild and domesticated grape in these various regions. you know, making comparisons, but then also looking at ancient DNA of grape and seeing if we can make comparisons with a specific region, and then dating, you know, as best we can, you know, when that earliest domestication could have occurred. You've also got to have some knowledge of horticulture to be able then to take that domesticated plant and actually move it from place to place, introduce it. So you take cuttings or roots or buds, and you have to then transplant those to other regions. But it's just that one species, that Eurasian species, that then ultimately spread out, you know, around the world, you know, only reaching California maybe in the last 50 years in any measurable way. But there are many other species of grape, but so far we don't have any archaeological, chemical, or really botanical evidence that shows that they were domesticated at a very early date. And we don't even have you know, clear evidence for the Eurasian grape that it was domesticated at an early date, say, in Spain. They really had to wait until there was an influence coming from the Near East, you know, and vines being transplanted sequentially, you know, across the Mediterranean, before we get really clear evidence that European viticulture, you know, starts to take off, and they start to develop their own wine cultures.
Now, your work is heavily interdisciplinary or multidisciplinary, however you want to put it, if you're not in particular engaged. But now you've got molecular biologists even involved. What are they adding to the conversation?
Well, this whole notion of how DNA, if we can take samples, you know, from ancient material, ancient seeds, grape seeds, extract the DNA, and then make comparisons and isolate parts of the genome, you know, that is going to tell us whether it's domesticated and, you know, how the whole story really develops with the domestication and subsequent spread of viticulture from one place to another. There is actually, I mean, the big advantage of the domesticated grape is that it is hermaphroditic. That is, it has the male and female parts of the flower together. And so there's no problem with pollination by wind. I mean, the wild plant has separate male flowers and separate female flowers. So you actually have to get the wind or mechanically transfer the pollen from the male over to the female. In the domesticated Eurasian grape, they're right together in the same flower. So that assures a lot more fruit being produced. And then you can see that if you're going to have any sort of mass production of wine, I mean, the hermaphroditic domesticated grape is the way you want to go. And there is actually a gene that determines, you know, whether you get a male, female, or hermaphroditic individual grapevine. And if you were able to take ancient DNA from grape and identify that particular gene as being hermaphroditic, you can say then for sure that you've got a domesticated grapevine.
Okay. Well, now you and I could be sitting here, as I know you are, enjoying a glass of wine, but for the ancients, there were other reasons other than just the wonderful taste of wine for drinking it. Would you explain that a bit?
Well, I mean, it goes far beyond, you know, just all the sensory delights of wine, because it really is became a symbol. Of course, a religious symbol. I mean, we just have to look at our Western religions to see, you know, how important wine is. It's right at the center of each of our Western religions, especially as a symbol of blood. But then beyond that, especially among kings and the upper class, wine became a sort of symbol of conspicuous consumption, you might say. So, you know, after you had a great victory in war, or you know, killed the lion or hippopotamus, you would celebrate with a grand feast, at which wine would be the way that you really demonstrated that you were all-powerful. And you had special drinking sets and so forth that you used to serve the wine. And these were then made as gifts from one king to another. So you had one king trying to imitate another and, of course, you know, bringing in the best wine, the best wine sets and so forth. So, you know, slowly but surely, you get the upper class and the royalty especially interested in wine, so they start importing it. And then the next step is to actually bring in the grapevine and get a winemaking industry going. And that we can track, you know, from one place to another through time.
Were there also health reasons?
Well, then you also have the whole issue of medicine. Because, you know, before we had the development of, you know, modern synthetic drugs and so on, I mean, alcohol was one of the principal medicines. And I mentioned before, you know, tree resins in combination with wine. I mean, these are the two ingredients that go into much of ancient medicine, and for good reason, because, I mean, if you drank just water, you run the risk of picking up all kinds of microorganisms and getting sick. But if you drink a fermented beverage, such especially wine, which has a high alcoholic content, you're going to live longer, and you're probably going to reproduce a great deal more.
So there were lots of reasons for drinking wine to begin with.
Oh, I mean, I think it, you know, it's a social lubricant, it eases tensions. I mean, just like, you know, we come home from a hard day at the office, you know, in antiquity, you know, you're out working in the field all day, and if you didn't have your glass of beer at the end of the day, I mean, you know, you would definitely rebel against the pharaoh.
Well, we only have a minute left. Maybe you could just, in very brief form, could you sort of summarize how wine was made in the ancient world and how that might differ from the way we do it today?
Well, I don't know. You know, some of the best methods today probably, you know, are still using techniques that go back thousands of years. I mean, I just came back from a trip to northern Portugal, where I went up the Douro River to the area where they make port wine, and they're still stomping the grapes up there. In fact, I even got into the vat and stomped the grapes, and you can make a very good case that the human foot is actually a lot better than any mechanical device. You don't actually break the seeds, you know, when you use a human foot, and that keeps, you know, very bitter tannin substances from getting into the wine. And, of course, oak, aging in oak is something now that we have molecular evidence on Crete going back to 1700 B.C., or at least oak is in there, is, you know, in the jar that we analyzed, and you know, then you get into a question of whether the treading vat was made out of oak, or did they, you know, age it in oak somehow. You know, like another issue is leaving the juice or the must to ferment on the lees. You know, where you've got grape skins and mm-hmm. yeast and so forth that can add special flavors. So, I mean, a lot of winemakers now are, you know, going back to some of these more traditional techniques and experimenting with them. I think that at the same time, you know, modern science has a great deal to tell us about, you know, how to make, you know, very consistent, delicious wines too, you know, in terms of the various kinds of fermentation processes, the yeast that are involved. But, you know, you need to still keep some of these traditional techniques, too.
Well, it's always good to have somebody on the show who gets into his work with both feet. And I hope you enjoy your glass of wine there. And thank you for joining us. It was very interesting.
Well, you know, when you sip that glass of wine, you're really recapitulating history, too.
Well, great. You've been listening to Patrick McGovern, Senior Research Scientist at the University of Pennsylvania's Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology and the author of Ancient Wine, The Search for the Origins of Viniculture, published by Princeton University Press. And this is Talking History.